Beverly didn't want you sitting by her, John, so...
I found somebody better looking.
At least you're related to him.
Same G,
not Arkansas, no. Okay, so we're going to be on chapter 8 tonight. I'm filling in for David, so he'll be back next week. He's in a gospel meeting this week, and I believe he said last week he was going to cover chapter 9 next week, I think. If I remember correctly, so we're going to cover chapter 8, miracles, signs of God or gullibility. So, Southern, I feel compelled to say the views and opinions expressed in this class by me do not reflect those of David Banning, so you get what you get. David also mentioned at the beginning of the quarter that as we got into the end of the quarter, we were start referencing passages out of the Bible, and as we go through the book, we'll start doing that tonight. We're going to look at some examples of miracles and discuss those. I think what gets us in trouble a lot nowadays when we talk about miracles is we use that term kind of loosely, don't we? I mean, anything that's kind of amazing, we say, well, that's a miracle, you know? And I think that gets us in trouble sometimes. It kind of takes away the amazement and the supernatural occurrence of the miracles that we read about in not only the New Testament, but the Old Testament as well. So tonight, we're going to look at, you know, what is a miracle? How does God use miracles? What are the objections? There's a couple of objections that are out there that are to miracles. And as you read through those, I don't know if you were like me, I read through them, it's like, well, yeah, duh. I mean, that's kind of makes sense when you refute the objections to it. We'll look at what's not a miracle. We'll touch on a couple of things there and why miracles don't occur today. And then we're going to look at, I have three examples of miracles I want to look at in the New Testament and kind of apply some of the things that we learned about miracles tonight to those. That way we have a different perspective on the miracles in the Bible and why they were recorded for us and how we take those and how we apply those going forward. So, in short, so what is a miracle? Question. And you can cheat. You can go to the book.
It's an event that defies nature.
Okay. An event that defies nature.
It glorifies the Creator and not the creature.
Okay. To the glory of God, in this case. So a miracle, I think is expressed here on page 201. A miracle is a special act of God that interrupts the normal course of events. So it's something that would not normally happen. In fact, there's a quote in there by Anthony Flew, who's an atheist. He said, a miracle is something which would never have happened had nature, as it were, been left to its own devices. Well, duh, it's supernatural. It's not natural. So the author goes on to say, you might say that natural laws describe what happens on a regular basis, whereas miracles, if they occur, they describe what happens rarely by supernatural causes. So that's a miracle in a nutshell. We talk about all sorts of things in life being a miracle. We talk about the miracle of birth. Is giving birth to a child a miracle? And I say that with newborns in the room. Sorry. One on two. Is it really a miracle? Is it an amazing event?
Amazing.
It is absolutely an amazing event. Is it a miracle?
It doesn't defy the laws of nature.
It's been, since the beginning of time, a natural process to give birth. It's amazing, yes. I was there for the birth of my daughter. I'll never forget it. It was amazing. We talk about, and I'm going to go back to my childhood. The one event I remember is in 1980 is the American hockey team defeating the Soviet Union in hockey. And they call it the miracle on ice. And in fact, in the closing moments of the match, of the game, Al Michaels, you hear him say, do you believe in miracles? And as the horn goes off, he screams, yes. And not a miracle. Yes, if we had played the Soviets 100 times, they might have won 99. But on that one night, the Americans won. It was an amazing event. It was a rare event. The odds of it happening were very small, but there was a chance, and evidently enough of a chance that they followed through, and they were able to win. Not a miracle, just an amazing event that rarely happened in that case. There's the 1983 NC State Wolfpack basketball team. They had to win their conference tournament, and then they went on to win the national championship. I forgot, who did they defeat? Oh, University of Houston, I'm sorry.
You have to bring that up.
I'm sorry.
Yes, I know this.
But it wasn't a miracle. Was it unexpected? Yes. Were the odds of NC State winning very small? Absolutely. There was no way they should have beaten Hakeem Olajuwon and Clyde Drexler and Larry Meshaw and all those guys. There's no way that should have happened. But it happened. Not a miracle. So a miracle, as we said, is a special act of God that interrupts normal course of events. So I think we just need to be careful in our modern day vernacular how we use the term miracle. Let's kind of pull back from that in our everyday vernacular when we talk about amazing things. So why does God use miracles? Why did God use miracles as they are recorded in both the Old and the New Testament?
Confirm the word.
Okay, to confirm the word. What else?
To establish who he is.
To establish who he is? Kind of in connection with confirming the word?
To give credibility to the person.
Okay, the messenger.
The messenger.
The prophet in the case of, in the case of Moses, he performed miracles in front of Pharaoh to show that he was from God. We have examples of Elijah performing miracles. In the New Testament, of course, we have examples of Jesus performing miracles. We have examples of the apostles performing miracles to show that they were from God and that they were messengers from God, and what they were delivering to the people was from God. So to confirm the message from God, to tell the world who is speaking on behalf of God. Give me a good passage that explains why God uses miracles. 20 The one I always use is John chapter 20, 30 and 31. What's it tell us about the signs that Jesus performed?
Written so you may believe.
Right. But first it says, how many signs? Many that weren't even recorded in the book, right? Before I misquoted. Many other signs, therefore, Jesus also performed in the presence of the disciples, which are not written in this book. So aside from all the ones that were written in the book of John and the rest of the epistles, and the rest of the Bible, but these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that believing you may have life in his name. So believe that he's from God. And the message that he is bringing is from God. So, that brings us to a couple of objections about miracles. And if you turn to, I think it's page 203. Yes, ma'am. Go ahead.
I might miss something because I was looking something up. He used miracles sometimes to take care of his people.
Okay. But it also, by taking care of his people, it also showed that he was God, that he was in control, that he was the supreme being as well, right? Exactly.
Right. I was thinking of the widow in the Old Testament.
Yeah, with Elisha.
Right.
Yeah. Provided for his people as well. So there's a couple of objections to miracles. The first one is by name, a man named Benedict Spinoza. He's I think we're on 203, 3. Yeah, he's a what's called a panthesis. What is that? A pantheist, I guess you would actually pronounce it that. Yeah, you know, usually when you think of pan, you think of all, right? So you like it's like someone who believes in all deities or something like that. It's actually not. It's that God is not the creator of the world, but that the world is part of God. So that they believe that God and the world are the same thing. And so that's why he expressed this view that natural laws are immutable. In other words, they cannot be changed. And so that was his initial argument. And his argument goes something like this. It's 4 points. Miracles are a violation of natural laws. Natural laws are immutable. It is impossible to violate immutable laws. Therefore, miracles are impossible. So that's how he gets to the fact that miracles are impossible. So the first one, miracles are a violation of natural laws. You agree or disagree with that? I agree with that. That's absolutely the case. Miracles absolutely violate natural laws. His second point building on that is natural laws are immutable, or natural laws cannot be changed. Is that true?
We can change.
From a human standpoint.
God didn't exist.
That's the whole idea behind miracles. No. It's going beyond nature.
Only God can do that.
Well, okay. But careful. Because we can alter natural laws, can we not? I think one of the examples that he gives in the book is gravity. How can we alter the natural law of gravity?
Getting an airplane.
Yeah, well, birds, first of all, birds do it all the time.
Yeah. Well, so, it doesn't change the law of gravity.
It doesn't change it, but it does.
And it takes advantage of it.
Right. It does take advantage of it.
You wouldn't actually be flying an airplane if you didn't have gravity.
Right. But this whole point of these four is almost circular reasoning, because the whole point behind a miracle is that it's not natural, that it is supernatural. And so to say, well, they can't occur because natural laws can't change, but that's what a miracle is. A miracle is a change in a natural law. So
I mean, I think his 2 and 3 sort of go together. They have to be paired together, but we know that someone that creates laws has the ability to change them, obviously.
Right, but how do you, and I agree, but then how do you reason that with someone who doesn't believe, in the case of an atheist, how do you reason with someone who doesn't believe in God in the first place, so there's not someone who can change natural law? That's a challenge I have. That's a struggle I have. So I don't know how you might go about doing that without putting them off or having them not be able to respond to you or discuss with you any further. But he almost indicates that there's no way that natural laws can be overpowered or interrupted or interfered with. And that was kind of the point I was getting to. And I think that's the point that the author is getting to here, too. Is those laws can be interrupted. We can defeat gravity through air flight. So there's that. So miracles, again, if he's right, if those things can't be changed, then miracles are impossible. But the Creator, who created the laws, can overpower those laws and change them for his purpose. So, of course, the greatest miracle of all, we would argue, is the creation of the universe out of nothing already, and that has already occurred. So, there's nothing natural about something being created out of nothing, is there? We've kind of had this discussion before. That's not natural. That has to be supernatural. So, we're here. So, some miracle occurred because something came from nothing, right? So, again, that's kind of defeating the point of Spinoza in this case, too. So, you know, something didn't come from nothing, but here we are. But we can temporarily change the natural laws when we, again, when we fly planes or when we, you know, gravity and change, we just simply overpower it. And I think that's kind of the point that Spinoza had, is that not so much that natural laws can't be changed, but they can't be interrupted or overpowered or interfered with or temporarily changed as well. So so that was kind of his argument there, is that natural laws can't be changed, so you can't have miracles. But when I first hear that, I'm like, well, duh. I mean, that's what makes a miracle, so. I was telling someone before class, this chapter is a little challenging because there's a lot of circular reasoning going on here. And you're talking about miracles, which are events that people who believe in God believe in miracles. And when you're trying to discuss this with an atheist doesn't believe in God, therefore they're not going to believe in miracles. So it makes it a little difficult to reason with.
Yeah, and I do think this argument that he's making that overpowering is the same as changing is probably not a good argument.
It's a little stretch, yeah.
It's, yeah.
And so, I think you used the word temporary, and I think that's, we see that as a miracle, but take a knee replacement. That's amazing. But it's only going to last maybe 10 years.
Yeah,
it's not, if you're looking. Even flying, you can't stay up there forever. You got to come down. Gravity's going to bring you down one way or another.
Exactly.
So I think the temporary was the key. The blind man who restored his sight, he didn't go blind a week later. He was able to see
right
from that point on.
And we'll talk about the lame man. That's one of the three
I
want to talk about.
But I decided to go blind.
No, go lame. Good, because we're going to go lame later. So, but not too many today because of advancement in technology where we can temporarily overcome some of these natural laws. So not too many today really believe in that natural laws are immutable in the case that we can't temporarily overcome. Which brings us to another fellow by the name of David Hume. We talked a little bit about him, I think, in chapter 2 of this book. But David Hume suggests that miracles are not credible. So his reasoning goes like this. Natural law is by definition a description of a regular occurrence. A miracle is by definition a rare occurrence. The evidence of the regular is always greater than that for the rare. And this is where he loses me. Because a wise man always bases his belief on the greater evidence. Sounds a little condescending there. And he says, therefore, a wise man should never believe in miracles. So let's break down his five steps again. And these are on, where are these? Page
205.
205, thank you, the bottom of 205. Natural law is by definition a description of a regular occurrence. Yes, no? Regular occurrence, natural law, we can kind of be on that page. A miracle is by definition a rare occurrence. Now don't misquote this. Not all rare occurrences are miracles, but I would say all miracles were rare occurrences. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
We're good on that? So this is, and then he starts losing me on point number three. The evidence for the regular is always greater than for the rare. So the regular occurrence evidence is always greater than that of the rare. Is that necessarily true?
So he doesn't believe that the U.S. defeated the Soviet Union.
That's okay. I wasn't going to use that one, but
they say they
didn't. That's not natural law.
Okay. Let's go back even further. Let's go back to the beginning. Creation.
Yeah.
That's pretty rare. It happened how many times? Once. It happened one time. Pretty sure there's evidence for that it happened.
Yeah, but if you had two witnesses telling the truth and five witnesses telling lies.
All right, don't get ahead of me. You're right, John. You're right. And we're going to touch on that in just a little bit, right?
Sorry, Troy.
We have the witnesses coming up too as well. So,
this
so
no.
Huh? Hey, David would have done the same thing.
It's good.
It requires believing in the Bible, but we've got evidence in the Bible that there are many witnesses that saw these miracles and
right.
would admit that they occurred. And
right, hold on, put a pin in that. We'll get there. I promise. So the origin of the universe happened only once. Regular or rare? That's a rare occurrence. The origin of life happened only once. regular or rare? The origin of life. That's rare. The origin of new life forms coming from life happens. It's pretty rare. So in fact, the entire history of the world is comprised of rare, unrepeatable events. Although, if we had to defeat the Soviets again, that may be a, I don't know. I mean,
not in our lifetime.
Well, I don't know. We could go back together and then whatever, but maybe not. But it's still rare. So his premise number three, and he talks about this in the book, about Hume's premise number three, it confuses believability with possibility. So the example I came up with, this one was Jesus being risen from the dead. Is it believable? Is it possible? So would you say Jesus rising from the dead is from a, just from looking at it from our realm, is it believable? Is it really believable? Is a man rising from the dead a believable occurrence? Not in our lifetime, right? And not in pretty much the history of the world. Is it possible? It's possible. Hard to believe, but possible. So if you can verify through witnesses the body was dead. We have secular record that the body was dead. We have secular recordings that the body was buried.
It was predicted.
Well, and also it was predicted too. But I'm just going, you know, straight off of, you know, if we look at historical accounts, yeah, it was foretold. But the body was dead. It was buried. We have historical evidence. It was written evidence that it was missing. And then we have written evidence that it appeared to many witnesses after that. So Hume's premise number three would say you can't believe it, even though there's evidence and witnesses, because it was a rare event. His premise number five would say then you were a fool for doing so. And that's, I didn't quite like his fourth and fifth point because it seemed a little condescending on that as well. So does that make sense, the believability and the possibility? There's also, the author talks about Hume's premise, his third premise, also confusing probability with evidence. And again, get back to your evidence here, John. So a hole-in-one in golf is very rare, is it not?
Rare.
It's close as I've been to a hole-in-one was the other green, the other fairway. about 10 years ago, I don't know, we had like 40 or so go play golf one time from Kleinwood. And I was, the foursome I was with, we were on a green, and the next fairway over was a par three. And all I could hear was Ken O'Neill yelling, Paul Thornton got a hole in one on the, and don't tell Ken I did that.
It's right there.
Yeah, sorry, Ken. Two things I knew
the
for a fact.
The evidence is on the wall.
Two things I knew for sure. I knew Ken O'Neill was announcing something, and what he announced was Paul Thornton hit a hole in one, and he did. There was four witnesses, including Paul, that it happened. Was it a regular occurrence? No, holes in ones are not a regular occurrence. It was a rare occurrence. But there were witnesses, and we had no trouble believing it. So again, that's that probability and evidence. So Hume's failure is that instead of evaluating the veracity of the evidence for each miracle claim, he just rules it out. He rules out the belief in miracles in advance. What do you think he rules out the belief in miracles in advance?
It's
why
convenient.
Does he?
Yeah. Why is it convenient, Randy?
Because if he has to deal with the idea that a miracle is really possible, then he has to deal with the existence of God. He doesn't want to do that.
And if he has to deal with the existence of God, then he has to accept that God is creator.
He's
the ultimate authority. Right. If he's the ultimate authority, then what do I have to do as one who recognizes him as their ultimate authority? I have to follow his standards. So, which to me is the underlying belief of most atheists is one, they want to do what they want to do, therefore they don't want to be subjected to God's standards. So the best thing to do is what?
Eliminate God.
Eliminate the standard, right? Eliminate God. So although Hume correctly defines a miracle as a rare event, he does punish it for being a rare event. So if you look at his quote on 208, he says, if only miracles happened more often, then we would believe them. Well, then it's not a miracle. I mean, if we're happening all the time, it's not that miraculous. It's more, it would seem more natural, wouldn't it? He says, but if miracles happen only more often, say regularly, which is using Hume's terminology, then they would cease to be miracles. They would cease being rare events. It might be considered them. We might consider them natural laws, are part of unexplained natural phenomena. So he kind of, again, it's that circular reasoning again, and so talk's a good game, but this doesn't quite add up, if you will. So. Those are the two objections that the authors bring out for miracles. Questions or comments on objections to miracles? My bottom line is on that is that people object to miracles because they object to God because they don't want to follow God. Pretty simple.
Can you use scripture? Because it says in 1 Corinthians 1:27, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to shame the wise.
Yeah. Right. Okay.
I would just ask them if they believe in aliens, why would it be so hard to, such a stretch to believe in?
Well, and some of them have gotten to the point where they don't like the something can't come from nothing, so they use the, oh, well, then it must have been aliens that mm-hmm. created, and then because... Well, you still got aliens, but no one's been able to prove that, and there's no, until, they're just kicking a can down the road until.
Right, but then the question
are these atheists
is, where
still
did
alive?
The aliens come from? I mean, you're still starting with something.
I know, I didn't say it made sense. I just said they're just kicking the can down the road. What was that, John?
These atheists that are claiming to be atheists, are they still alive? They either are atheists or former atheists.
Well, okay, yes. Yes, you're right. If one day, every knee, as John pointed out in his song service this morning, every knee will bow. Not just those who believe, but every knee will bow and recognize God as the ultimate authority. Okay, so what's not a miracle? So we said a miracle, it can't be explained naturally. But what else about, before we start talking about what isn't a miracle, there's a couple points I want to stress about what a miracle is. And we talked about one of them, and that's being, it's from God, it cannot be explained naturally. But there's another aspect of a miracle that I want us to consider this evening, and we'll look at it in more detail when we look at three of the miracles in the New Testament. It has a specific purpose. If you look at every miracle that is performed in the Old and New Testament, there is a specific purpose from Moses, including Elisha feeding the widow and the son. There's a purpose to every miracle. So I want, if that wasn't on your radar, put it on your radar the next time you're reading scripture and you read about a miracle that's been recorded in either the Old or New Testament. But what isn't a miracle? And one of the ones I kind of want to touch on is probably the most familiar kind of unusual event, and that's magic. So magic is based, what's magic based on?
Deception,
human sleight of hand, misleading the mind, right? So every 2 years, I teach the 7th and 8th grade class, and there is a lesson we go through on the book of Acts every 2 years and talk about the different conversions that occur. And we get to Acts chapter 8 and we talk about Simon the sorcerer. And Simon the sorcerer, when he hears the word, he's converted, he sees the signs that Philip performs, he sees the miracles that Peter performs later when Peter gets there. He knows the difference. Now, Simon's basically, for lack of a better term, he's called Simon the sorcerer, he's a magician. He's not doing anything supernatural. He's doing sleight of hand. He's being deceitful. Simon knows the difference between what's magic and what's a miracle. Now, David alluded to a card trick. I'm not going to do the card trick in class. I saved that for the 7th and 8th graders. So if you had a kid that's in the 7th and 8th grade and they said, Mr. Treat did a card trick for us, this is why I did the card trick. So it's a show. It's a fun example. It shows the difference between what magic is and what's a miracle. So we do this card trick, and I bet, you know, they pull a card, and I do all sorts of stuff and mislead them and draw their attention away and end up putting a card on the table that said they said it wasn't their card, and it ends up being their card. And I tell them, all right, did Mr. Treat miraculously turn that card into two of clubs? And they're like, no, you did some kind of magic that was out. I said, no. So that's the difference between magic and a miracle. We see magic and illusions all the time. Those are not miracles. And that's one thing I wanted to stress, is that magic is not miracles. Anomalies, these are rare occurrences that happen, or what the author calls freaks in nature. And so this is one of my favorite ones, the bumblebee, okay? How in the world does a bumblebee fly? Have you seen a bumblebee? It's like that big around, and the wings are like that small. You know, how does it fly? Now some people would say that's a miracle of life. You know, it's just an anomaly. It's just a freak of nature. It naturally occurs. It occurs many places, not a miracle. And we can save psychosomatic, satanic signs, providence for another class, or y'all can ask David about that. I'm not getting into all of that. But the bottom line is that the miracles they can't be explained naturally, they have a specific purpose. Okay, so with the remainder of our time, I want to look at three. Well, let's talk about, before we get to the three miracles, why don't miracles occur today?
We have the complete word of God.
Okay. Because if the Bible is true, and if it's complete, then God is no longer confirming any new revelation, right? So that was the purpose of miracles. We all agreed to that. The purpose of miracles was to confirm the word of God, to confirm the messenger that was delivering that word of God. So if there are no new revelations, then there's not this main purpose for performing miracles today. So.
But our neighbors don't believe that.
That's a topic for almost, that's another class, because you could spend two or three classes. In fact, I think we spent a whole quarter on talking to others about the Bible and about the Word. So yeah, so that's just another thing to be aware of when you're speaking to your neighbors or your coworkers. So there really is no new word from God that needs to be confirmed by God. Okay, now I want to look at three specific miracles in the New Testament. So you actually have to get your Bible out now in this class. So the first one is in John chapter 2. And as we look at these, I want to think about a couple of different ways or additional things to look at when we look at these miracles. So John chapter 2, this is the miracle at the marriage of Cana. What happens at the miracle? What's the miracle at the marriage of Cana?
Water
to wine. This is also a discussion for another class. For this purpose, we're not talking grape juice, we're talking wine. I'll just leave it at that. We can discuss it another time. And you'll see why as I go through the miracle, okay? So what was miraculous about turning water into wine? Don't you need water to make wine? What's the big deal then?
Time. Process.
And you need grapes.
Well, grapes, okay. You didn't need grapes. That's right.
A minor detail I know.
Fermentation.
A big thing for wine is what? In order for it to be wine, it has to be fermented. And as John mentioned, John Matthews, not John Zelny, sorry, I'll point to the other John. It takes what? There is a time component to this. So how long does it take to make a vat of wine? I don't know, because I'm not an expert on wines. I don't know how long it takes. I know it takes longer than it took Jesus to do it, right? A lot longer. Fermentation, anybody know how long fermentation takes? How long it takes to?
It takes like 12 days to make vinegar, I think. I'm not really sure.
10 to 12 days.
A long time.
I don't know.
Days.
All right. We'll take days, if not weeks. Right. So, what was miraculous about this? How long did it take Jesus? How long did it take Jesus to turn the water to wine?
Immediately.
It was almost immediately, right? I mean, what does it say? Does it even say What did he say? He said, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them to the brim, and he said to them, "Draw some out and take it to the head waiter." And they took it to him, and the head waiter tasted the water, which had become wine. When did that happen? Sometime between now and then, it happened, right? Tasted wine and did not know where it had come from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew. The head waiter called the bridegroom and said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first. And when men have drunk freely, then the which is poor, and you have kept the good wine until now." So the couple of points with this particular miracle. The first one is, how long did it take Jesus to turn water to wine?
Time to fill the pot.
If that long. If it wasn't doing it while it was filling it, right? So, natural occurrence, supernatural occurrence. That's supernatural. That's a supernatural occurrence, right? Yeah. But one of the things I wanted to express about each miracle is that there's a purpose behind every miracle. Did you read the purpose? I kind of skimmed over it real quick. But if you know it from the past, what's the purpose of this miracle? And I'll give you a hint. It's basically referred to in verse 10. He said to him, every man serves the good wine first, and when men have drunk freely, then that which is poor, you have kept the good wine until now. Typically at a feast, the good wine is served first, and then you bring out the poor quality ones after that, right? What happened in this case? Was the first good or the second good? Which was the case in this case?
The first was good, the second was better.
First was good. That's good. I like that. First was good. The second was better. What's the purpose of this miracle? You see the point there?
Verse 11 also.
The first covenant was good. The second covenant was
better.
Moses and the prophets were good. Jesus was better. Right. So there's a purpose behind this miracle. He's not just doing it to confirm that he's deity, that he's a messenger from God. There's also an underlying message here, the first and the second. So the second is better than the first. Y'all see that? So I'll ask you that as you read miracles throughout the Old and New Testament, you'll see some underlying meaning there besides the fact that it's showing that the messenger and the message is from God. So that was the first one I want to look at. The next one, I think this is my favorite, John chapter 11, the raising of Lazarus. Let's see, where do I want to start on this? Well, just some background. So Lazarus is sick, and as soon as Jesus finds out Lazarus is sick, he runs to his rescue, right? No, he waits. Why does he wait? I'm sorry?
To prove it.
Okay.
That he was dead.
Okay, so let's go to 17. So now Jesus arrives. So when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb for how long?
4 days.
4 days. And I'm going to stop there real quick. Are there occasions where we bring people back from the dead today?
Four days.
If that long. Yeah.
Right, if even.
If someone flatlines, is there occasions where they're brought back?
Sure.
Now, someone argued they weren't clinically dead, but okay, I get it. The heart stopped, but we brought them back. But in how long were they gone? Minutes, maybe, right? Yeah, minutes. 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. Martha, therefore, when she had heard that Jesus was coming, went to meet him, but Mary still sat in the house. Martha, therefore, said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." True statement? I think so. I think if Jesus had been there, Jesus could have chosen to heal him before he died.
That's true.
Right. But even now, I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. So Martha's got some belief here. She's like, you know, whatever you ask of God, that's going to happen. I believe. And Jesus said to her, "Your brother shall rise again." And Martha said to him, "I know he'll rise again in the resurrection on the last day." And Jesus said, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me shall live even if he dies. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this?" And she said, "Yes, Lord. I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, he who comes into the world." And he said, and when she said that, I'm sorry, when she had said this, she went away and she called Mary, her sister, saying secretly, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she had heard it, she quickly arose and was coming to him. So it goes on, and in verse in verse 38, Jesus, therefore, again being deeply moved within, came to the tomb. Now it was in a cave, and the stone was lying against it. And he said, "Remove the stone." Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he has been dead 4 days." So not only dead, he's ripe. I mean, he is good and dead. So Jesus said to her, "Did I not say to you, if you believe, you will see the glory of God?" And they removed the stone, and Jesus raised his eyes and said, "Father, I thank thee that thou hearest me, and I knew that thou hearest me, always, and because the people were standing around, I said it, that they may believe that thou didst send me." And when he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lazarus, come forth." And he who had died came forth, bound hand and foot with wrappings, and his face wrapped around with a cloth. And Jesus said to him, "Unbind him and let him go." 4 days. And Jesus raised him from the dead. We see here written that it says he did this to show the people there that he was from God, and that he had the authority, and God had given him the power, and God had the power. Randy?
As you read that, one of the interesting parts of this story that I find really fascinating is Martha's, and the role she plays here, because when you look at her, she has belief. She knows who Jesus is, and she states her belief, but she also realized the natural things that happen in life that her brother is dying. What she cannot sort of rectify in her mind is him coming back to life. And that's the key point here, I think, when we're talking about this particular miracle. Mm-hmm. It's not a lack of belief on her part. She believes that Jesus is the Christ. She also knows, because of a personal experience, that death occurs, people don't come back to life. She can't rectify those two in her own mind because she doesn't know how this works. What Jesus does is he shows the example between the physical world and the spiritual world and how he bridges that gap. And by bridging that gap, he could call Lazarus back to life when nobody else could, because he could play in both worlds, both realms, if you will. And that's what's really interesting, I think, about this particular story, is that Martha was right on. She was absolutely correct in everything she did and said. And yet Jesus was able to prove that there was something else that she didn't understand, and he was going to demonstrate that to her.
Right. What I like about Martha in this case, she actually looked well ahead. I mean, yes. She said, "I'm going to the resurrection. See, I know you're going to raise him in the last day, in the day of judgment," which, good for Martha. She was on that. But yeah, bridging that. I like the bridging of the gap there. So it doesn't come out and say it there like we had the first and the second, but What's the underlying purpose of this miracle? Keep in mind, in less than 2 weeks, what's going to happen? Christ is going to be crucified. What's the purpose of this miracle besides proving that he's the Son of God and that his message is from God? What's the other purpose of that?
That he will rise.
If God has the power to raise Lazarus from the dead, what's going to happen to Jesus? He has the power to raise Jesus from the dead. And not only that, if God has the power to raise Lazarus from the dead, and he has the power to raise Jesus from the dead, in the last day, what's he going to do with us as believers? He's going to raise us from the dead too. Not back to a physical life, but to an eternal life.
I think what little side note is, Jesus was there raising Lazarus. Nobody was standing there raising Jesus. Jesus just raised. I think that's.
But I like the detail that's involved in this too. Not just the dialogue with Martha, but the fact, you know, rolling the stone back, the being wrapped in grave clothes, as well, kind of gives us some foreshadowing to what happens around Jesus.
Just
as well.
One other comment about this, and why I find this miracle just so fascinating, is in order for Jesus to do what he did, he had to have the ability to reach into the spiritual world and call Lazarus' spirit back from wherever it was, right?
Right?
Back to the earth, and then somehow get it reinstated into his body, which was in decay, and have all of that repaired, and life breathed back into that physical body. That's, to me, is is a miracle. That is the pure definition.
And
of
how long
miracle.
Did it take Jesus to do that?
Seconds.
Yeah. I mean,
Jesus says,
instantly.
Wait, golf.
Right.
Now, the significance of about 4 days, the Jews believed that the spirit hung around the body for 3 days.
Right.
So fourth day, the spirit would have left.
It gets to the point that Randy was making about the separation of body and soul and bringing it back together. Yeah.
I always wonder what it looks like when it's coming out.
I'm sure he was. Yeah.
He was probably as surprised as everybody else.
I'm sure he was. Yeah. So, but even though this was a miracle, even Lazarus was brought back to life, ultimately what happened with Lazarus? And what's happened to all of us? He's going to, he died. I mean, he's not with us. He's not around anymore. That's kind of the main difference between Lazarus and Jesus. Jesus rose never to die again. So, all right, 2 minutes, and we got the last one I want to look at just real quick is the healing of the lame man at the pool in John chapter 5. This was an event. There's a couple of things here. First thing, it happened on the Sabbath. Uh-oh, here we go. Jesus isn't doing stuff on the Sabbath. And this lame man had been lame how long? It said 38 years. I'm assuming that's how old he was. I don't think it said that, but 38 years he was lame. And Jesus tells him what? Stand up and walk. Now, can we heal? If someone's been in an accident and they lose the use of their legs, but doctors can fix that, right? I mean, if you're lame, you can fix it. It usually takes hours of surgery, weeks of physical therapy before you can start walking normally like you did again. Sometimes you have to learn to walk again. In the case of the lame man, what happened?
Immediately.
Again, there's that time component. What's the purpose behind this one? Besides the fact that Jesus is all-powerful, that he is proven that he is the Son of God, and his message is from the Son of God also. It has nothing to do with the lame man. It has to do with when he healed the lame man.
No time hinders God.
Well, no time hinders God, but he performed it on the Sabbath. He's Lord of the Sabbath. He created the Sabbath. What did he say in other places about the Sabbath?
The Sabbath was created for man.
Not man for the Sabbath. Right. So he's Lord of the Sabbath. He's the creator. He's the creator of time. He can heal instantly and completely. It wasn't that he just hobbled off. What did he do?
He could
walk like anybody else, right? Mm-hmm. All right. The bell's going to catch us here in a little bit. Chapter 9 next week. Any questions about miracles? David Banning at gmail.com. I think it's his email. That's not anyone. Thank you for your attention and your comments tonight. Appreciate it.